so the first question, Jonathan, you're the first question. Would you say who it's aimed at?
It's aimed at all of them. And it's about what the first two speakers definitely seem to include in their points, which was that there is a proper public role, social role for philosophers and philosophy. And so, first of all, I wondered whether the second two speakers would want to make the same point, that something should be done, more should be done to promote analysis or metaphysics in the public sphere, and more specifically to Bob, whether he has practiced or intends to practice going out in the streets and questioning people at random about their beliefs, and whether there should be a branch, say, of Samaritans, which deals with a particular for cosmological angst. That really was my question. How should they be getting out and doing something?
So that was for the second speakers. Oh, sorry, the first two speakers.
Why don't I answer, yes. When I was writing the speech, I was imagining Jeremy Paxman wearing shabby clothes and quite asking the sort of questions Socrates asked of politicians and other people he interviews, but of a much more basic kind. Actually asking them philosophical questions. So when, say, a prime minister says that we've lost a sense of responsibility, Paxman should be saying in the Socrates group, what exactly is a sense of responsibility? Which a lot of people think, well, it's obvious, isn't it? But it isn't, actually. And I think in investigating what you meant by a sense of responsibility, you could learn quite a lot about what you were talking about, and it would lead to a more intelligent discussion of whatever political problem was being discussed. So that's the sort of thing I'm giving. Paxman and Co. were philosophers rather than interested in party politics and whether the Labour Party or the Conservative Party are going to trip each other up. We could have some intelligent debates. So that's one practical area, well, very small area, which it could be useful.
I think one of the motivations behind this meeting and my talk is partly my view that philosophy should be trying to work out more clearly what it's trying to do in order to have a decent social role. At the moment, if you bring 10 philosophers onto Newsnight and ask them sort of what do you think the point of your subject, six of them will probably say it's completely pointless and should be abolished or something, and people will say, oh, it's about a huge loss of causes and stuff like this. And hardly anybody will actually say, well, what I was trying to say, which was, you know, that there is there's a strategy for trying to get an overview, a sort of broad, comprehensive wisdom about what's going on around here. And I think if you want to be invited on Newsnight to talk about the riots, you'd better get your own hats in order and get pretty clear about what it is you're trying to do, so that you can ring up the BBC and say, look, what we do is this, and would you like it? You know, so I think that's what we're after.
You seem to be raising two, as far as I can understand it, two separate questions. First of all, should there be a public role for philosophy? I think what I was saying is that there is one, and that what it is basically ideological. It's an ideology. If you think of ideology and science as being, in some sense, in combat with one another, which I do, then I think that philosophy is the ideology which is dealing in anti-science, really. And that doesn't mean that, you know, time doesn't exist and that, you know, there aren't individual philosophers who are trying to...
Yeah, towards your mouth.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. Ah, right, that's it. I can hear it now. It doesn't mean that, that, you know, the revolution was brought about by Klein and it happened and all that sort of stuff. But I think it does mean that if you look at philosophy as the social institution which I'm trying to look at it as, that's important, it is going to attract people, and does attract people, who are very worried about the direction in which science, usually seen as at least in part a baddie, though you always have to, of course, nod to science. So if you want to show your worry, you say, oh yes, of course, science is fine. It's this thing called scientism, which is. And I think that's just a bogeyman that's been invented in order for people not to feel bad about accepting science. So I think there is a public role, and it is, it has become ideological and fundamentally, I think, anti-science. But that doesn't mean to say, the second point is the point which I thought was interesting, what Peter raised, was when he began with that John Cottingham quote, definition rather, of metaphysics, talking in terms of us needing something which is beyond the particular sciences. I don't remember the actual wording, beyond the particular sciences. And here I would like to recommend a book which I've recently reread. It came out a long time ago. It has a strange title. It's called The Science of Science. And it came out in the 1960s, I think. And it's a collection of essays by very, very prominent scientists of the day. That's where my quote from Peter Kapitsa came from. I think it was him talking about his essay on the Golden Generation. And what these folk were arguing was that what was needed was they recognised the need for the general, and if philosophy has in some sense represented the general, then we can't afford to lose the general. And what they were saying was the general ought to become the science of science. Not the philosophy of science, but the science of science. And I think that's an interesting thought to pursue, if it's in.
Okay, I take a contrasting view. I don't think science is going to take over everything. I think science, if you have a kind of well-defined attitude towards science has particular strengths, but its strengths come from its very specific procedures. It measures the world, it gets numerical information about the world, but it doesn't tell you what the world is. In itself. I mean, there was a thing, someone raised a question earlier. Suppose someone tells you they believe in God, and they said, you wouldn't immediately understand what they meant, especially if it was the Church of England clergyman. But in conversation with them, and knowing what they said, you would have some vague idea of their meaning. And then the question asked, well, is there any, I forget what the word they used, is there any substance behind that meaning? Is there any proposition there behind the sentences that people say? And I think you can say the same thing about matter. You know, people, scientists come up with various sentences about matter, but then what is there behind all these things that scientists can say? Scientists can make measurements and so on. But to get down to what matter actually is, I don't think science can actually do that. As to what philosophy is, I think philosophy is simply, in its broadest sense, is just stepping back and reflecting kind of critically and constructively on whatever it is you're doing, so you can have a philosophy of everything. I don't think you can have a science of science, or a science of science, I think, would be something quite boring and interesting. It would be, you'd be kind of limited. You shouldn't be limited in any way to the way you think about the particular subject matter. you're concerned.
Just respond to what Anne said about the science of science. I take that to be a sort of crafty move to pinch our subject. So we have sort of increasingly general science, and then all this lovely stuff that we thought the science the philosophers were going to specialise in, sort of suddenly it's taken away with something with a bit more authority to it because it's based in empirical experiment. One of the things that issue is here is the status of the history of philosophy. And I've heard Anne comment rather than negatively about the significance for now of the history of philosophy. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can
express your own views. Let me just defend the history of philosophy in the sense that there are arguments that are put forward in place, and everyone thinks that's a really good argument, like sort of the Euthyphro dilemma or something like that that's been identified. Yeah. That's a dilemma, and it isn't going away. You know, it's a permanent discovery by Plato that there's a dilemma. Which comes first, piety or the gods? Is it the gods create piety or the gods live up to piety or something like that? You know, that kind of question pops up everywhere. And the Greek philosophers, never mind the later ones, are full of arguments like that. And those are permanent discoveries of a highly general nature. So if the scientists suddenly want to become highly general, they're going to have to do a philosophy degree. They can't just do it from the science, because it's all been done before. It's all mapped out pretty thoroughly.
I'd also like to just say something quickly about what Anne said. I think there's a huge difference between science and scientism, and that one can reject scientism without rejecting science. Science is the empirical study of whatever, whether it's the physical universe or the chemical universe or this, that, and the other. And scientism is the belief that science, in all its different forms, will one day explain everything, answer every question. And I think one can reject the claim that science will one day answer every question without rejecting, I don't even know what it would be to reject the empirical study of everything. Anyway, that's my response to something Anne said. Sorry, Anne, you've been got at here.
Can I respond to that?
Yes. Can I just say, and this is probably a bad moment to say it, two things. We've got 10 questions already and only 25 minutes to answer them in. And so could you keep them really concise? And that goes also for answers. And secondly, 41, not quite.
No, it's
just half past. Until half past, yeah. Okay, sorry, 40, so 7 minutes. Questions to all panellists should be avoided if possible. If you could answer a question from just one panellist, that would be great. If you can't, don't worry. Yes, Annie, I've got to give you a chance to respond.
Yes, I think that if you say that scientism is the idea that one day and eventually science, as long as you register that science isn't physics, I mean physics is a science, that one day and eventually science will answer all the questions that we're talking about, then I think that's the best hypothesis going. So if scientism then ceases to be a dirty word and just becomes another word for science. I think it's obvious I disagree. I hope it's obvious I disagree. Okay, Richard. This is where I they are.
This is a question from Peter Els. I reckon that pain is at one ontological level and that neurology and physiology are at another ontological level. And why would you expect anything other than a simple correlation between neurological and physiological events and pain events? Why would you want more than that correlation?
Okay. So you're being a polyrealist. You're being a realist about pain.
Yeah.
And also, I presume, a physicalist.
Yes.
But the problem with your position, I think, is that I think Thomas Nagel is the closest position to yours. If you have things at a higher level which cannot be reduced to physics, and moreover, the earlier physicalists thought that everything could be reduced to physics and expressed in the language of physics. But I think it's fairly clear that things like pains exist at a higher level, as you say, but cannot be reduced to physics and can't even be described in the language of physics. But where you don't even have this kind of common language, you don't have any possible explanation, because an explanation requires some kind of linguistic grid to go from one sort of thing, the microphysics of the world, to the pain, if you like. And so,
then you're going through a whole raft of ontological levels, from quarks and leptons to molecules to cells to cell chemistry and transmission of neurological signals. There's a whole raft of levels that gets you down to quarks and leptons.
Yes.
So you can't expect a simple description.
No, but it doesn't matter how simple or complicated. It doesn't matter how many levels. You know, you could go through a million levels of greater and greater complexity. But if there's no linguistic link between pain as experienced and spatiotemporal behavior, which is what science gives us at any level, then you don't have an explanation.
And I'd actually like to support Peter on this. I can conceive of a universe in which everything was exactly as it is now, to the smallest neuron, but where nothing was conscious. I can't see any logical problem with that conception. But things are conscious. And I think that for science to work, it has to come up with an explanation as to why things are conscious, in addition to all the neuroscience. I think Daniel Dennett will say that question is meaningless, and probably will as well. But it puzzles me as a complete non-scientist.
I can conceive of the universe being precisely identical the way it is now, but lacking consciousness, but I don't think that means it's possible.
I'd just like to put out that was almost 5 minutes for one question.
I think that consciousness hides two things sit under consciousness when we're talking about it. One is sentience, and the other is what is usually referred to as consciousness. And sentience, it seems to me, is a biological phenomenon. And consciousness isn't, which doesn't mean that you haven't got a scientific explanation. It doesn't mean that you should not be searching for a scientific explanation for consciousness. What it means is that you've got to use the right science. You don't use biology. You use biology if what you want to understand is sentience. And I think the efforts to understand sentience in a biological domain are reasonably far advanced. I think the efforts to understand consciousness in a social and cultural domain are less so, but I would suggest that consciousness is simply, well, that's what you would say, simply with consciousness in the same sentence, but that consciousness is just the exercise of language inside our, as language restructures our sentient system. So to be conscious is simply, not simply, to be conscious is to use a linguistic system which restructures your biology in the sense of your brain. Restructures your biology in such a way that what comes out of here goes in again there with a delay. So you get this
not illusion, but you get this feeling of what we call consciousness. But that's incredibly vague, and I can't be any less vague than that. But it's something totally other than sentience, which I think is relatively easy to understand.
I would say that consciousness is second level sentience.
Is there a microphone?
No, you just speak up very loudly.
I was interested in the theme that ran through the whole, the four talks. I was interested to find a theme that ran through the four talks. And for me, the theme would be that the point of philosophy is to question our fundamental beliefs and understanding of ourselves and the world we live in, whether those beliefs are about God and virtues, whether they're about the language that we use and other people use, or whether they're about the material objects we see in the world around us. And the reason it's important to question our fundamental beliefs is that sometimes they're wrong. And history shows us that at any point in time, if you took all the fundamental beliefs that existed, eventually they will be proved to be wrong or to be modified in some way. And if I think about science, the last time there was a real question in the fundamental beliefs by scientists, just going back to the likes of Einstein with concepts as space time and simultaneity, and the likes of Heisenberg as well, with all sorts of concepts. So it's really a question to ask as to whether now is a good time, 100 years later, to revisit those assumptions, fundamental assumptions that science makes, in the sort of way that Peter advocates.
I think the idea that philosophy is the subject which gets us to question our beliefs is wrong. In fact, I don't think there is any subject that is directed towards getting us to question our beliefs. I think what philosophy does, as I've said in several different ways, and I was trying to say in another way, is what philosophy does is basically to try, I suppose, to avoid us questioning some of the longest lasting beliefs that have been around, which is not all of them, but the longest lasting ones. And I suppose the longest lasting ones of all are those beliefs which centre upon what is I. And a philosopher will tell you that I is an indexical, a way of talking about the self without investigating what the self is. And it does seem to me that we really are avoiding what is, well, not everybody is, but an awful lot of people are avoiding what is the central question of the day because it's too frightening. And I think the central question of the day is, what is a person? Are we really entities which make our way in the world, choosing to do one thing and not choosing to do another, not determined by anything, free to choose? Or is it the case that a person doesn't have its experience, but that a person is its experience, which is what I take to be the case? And if persons are their experience, and if each of us has a different experience, not just from birth, but probably from before birth as well, different experience, different amniotic fluids, for example. If we are our experience rather than we have it, in other words, if what I would call the having ideology is cracking up, then you have to acknowledge, I think, that we're not free-living entities. We're not the only thing in the whole of reality, which little tiny thing 6 foot tall on all of the planets, which can behave in ways differently from all the rest of the system of which we are a part. And that what is happening to us at the moment, and it is very, very disorienting, what is happening to us at the moment is that we're coming to understand the
I try to put it in my handout, the third epistemological break. The first one having concerned the universe, the second one having concerned the biosphere, and now the third one concerning the world. And if you say that that what philosophy does is attempts to get us to question our beliefs, and then you look at where philosophers for the most part line up in that debate, I think you probably find that what philosophers are doing is much more trying to stop us questioning our beliefs, trying to say no, it's all right. And if it's not too close to the bone, I think that you can see this incredibly clearly in our own one of our own blurbs for these years. Talks. There is one talk in November, next but one talk, which is about philosophy of mind, and this is its blurb. It says, the mind is a fascinating entity. Where, after all, would we be without it? But exactly what is it? These days, many people believe the mind simply is the brain. I don't know a single person who thinks that the mind is the brain. Many, many people, including myself, think that the mind is what the brain does. But the mind certainly isn't the brain. The mind is what the brain does. It minds. You know, mind ought to stay a verb rather than becoming a noun. Now, if this goes on, Descartes would have disagreed profoundly. He recommended a dualism of substance. Modern philosophers are again finding various forms of dualism attractive. Well, I suppose if you put philosophers in the plural, it's got to be two. So there probably are two modern philosophers who are finding various forms of dualism attractive. But I would have thought that really the main problem, as far as dualism is concerned, or the main stance, not only in the scientific world, but even in the philosophical world, I would say, is that dualism is a dead duck. And so, then it goes on to talk about the problems of physicalism, and it says, one such problem is whether the mind, like the brain, is located in space. But does philosophy have anything sensible to say about the mind? Surely today it is scientists which we should be listening to. And then it says, come and find out why this is, brackets, and always will be, false. Now, if that's not, I mean, I don't know who writes these things, but if that's I had my suspicions, but I didn't. If that is not exactly what I've been trying to talk about, that is philosophers. I would say in retreat, trying to say, good heavens, it's not only now that the mind and what philosophers have to say is important, but it's important, going to be important for all time. If that's not a promise,
I'm going to have to respond. Anne, you may disagree with what I say, but I say you have said it. Well, it doesn't matter who said it, but it wasn't that me. Yeah. you may disagree that. With my claim that people believe that mind is the brain, but actually, I teach philosophy of minds to many, many, many people every year, and the vast majority of them start off believing that the mind is the brain. That mental states are neural states, mental events are neural events, and so on. Let me finish.
Yes, sir.
So, you may disagree that the mind is the brain, but that doesn't entail that nobody believes that the mind is the brain. And I think you don't teach philosophy of mind to people, and therefore are perhaps not in a position as good as I am to say what people believe. Secondly, the idea about physicalism, the mind being located in space, I think that when we were talking about I'll come back to this because I want to find out what it was that you said that made me think about external. I know what it was something about the person. I completely agree with you that the I is not something inside the brain, inside the person, an internal thing. I think that I think there is an I, but I don't think it's anything like any of the things that we tend to think of the I as being. And I'm sorry, you just poured scorn over everything I've written there, and it's quite difficult for me to not come back with some sort of scorn.
Yeah.
When I said I don't think any, maybe probably I haven't said it properly. When I said I don't think anybody thinks,
that's
good.
That's good.
Yes. When I said that, I was referring not to the whole human race, but to people who are. At some level or other, experts, whether amateur or professional, in philosophy and in science. And I don't think of students in that category.
Well, let me just correct another thing. So there are many philosophers who are returning to dualism these days. I mean, anyone who embraces anomalous monism, for example, is a dualist of some kind. David Sharp, how many believe in anomalous monism? Many.
I can't name one, but you obviously could name one.
Well, you can't name one. Well, okay, you can't.
Well,
that doesn't mean there
aren't
any. Well, John McDowell.
Yes.
Donald Davidson, who's now. John Foster. John wouldn't accept. But, I mean, let's not... There are many, many philosophers. Go and look at the dualism entry in the Sanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Well, have another look. And then come back and tell me that there are not philosophers who believe in dualism.
I didn't say we weren't philosophers. I said if you present what's happening...
I'm sorry, we must carry on.
Could I suggest that a lot of second-rate philosophers have sold out to scientism?
Patrick! I think they're going to give up on the microphones, because actually, don't they make it worse?
Yes.
I mean, you can hear me at the back, can't you?
Yes.
And everyone else speaks as loudly as I do.
Well, just give me it now, so I might as well use it.
Okay. Well, that one's not so loud, actually.
Yeah, I'll try to move on. Yes. This is a bit about the relationship of philosophy to the history of philosophy, really. So I think probably either Robert or Peter, perhaps. It seems legitimate for most philosophers to take philosophical questions from one period to look for answers in philosophers of another period. And so this follows on, to what extent do you think is philosophy determined or limited by the conditions of the philosopher's own time and place?
If you want to start something, probably entirely. I mean, I like to think of myself as somebody who looks at all the available things that one could believe and think, and then by a rational process of examination comes to the right conclusion. But I can't help noticing that my views about virtually everything are more or less precisely identical with the spirit of the age, from which I conclude that, like everybody else, the views I hold are just caused by my education, my environment, what I read, to some extent the history of philosophy, insofar as I've read any. So I'm pretty cynical about this, but I don't believe in free will or any of that nonsense either. I mean, I'm just the product of everything that's come before. Which, of course, means that my views are completely useless.
There's no denying that fashion plays a huge role in philosophy. And I think probably everyone on the stage is guilty of holding views that are rather characteristic of some aspect of current thought. You know, we're all swept along in one tide or another, rather different sort of aspects of the tide, isn't it? I'm struck when I look back in philosophy that you read, I don't know, say you read through four Greek philosophers, and one of them seems so remote they're from another planet, and a couple of others seem sort of vaguely sort of interesting, and then one just strikes you as being so contemporary it sounds as if it was born yesterday. And I was reading Epicurus a few weeks ago, and I thought, my goodness, this bloke would be at home in a modern discussion. I mean, he just seems to be totally tuned into the modern world. And I think he was trying to philosophize for all time, and I think all philosophers are trying to philosophize for all time, and some of them get it right. Every time some new trend in current fashion appears, we suddenly realize that there was some guy back in the 18th century who was saying this, and we become very interested in him. Like Thomas Reid, for example, became a very fashionable philosopher sort of 20 years ago, because people suddenly spotted he was rather in tune with modern thinking. So I think everyone's aspiring to get it right, but this tide of fashion sort of pushes you one way or the other, and it's very difficult to sort of hang on to trying to get it right. I think we're trying to get it right.
This is Peter, a question to you. By the way, I've really enjoyed this, like Peter Gibson.
Yeah.
You said that you thought that maybe all of us in this room were doing philosophy to find out more about the world, really. But do you think we could also be doing it because of an interest with a dialogue with the subject, or just we want to have a job for it?
Dialogue with the subject.
Yeah, like a dialectic. The more we find out about the subject, maybe itself, not the world around us. I think he did say that what we were doing is just to find out more about the world.
Well, I sort of hang on to the mantra that the aim of philosophy is to understand reality. You know, that's what the subject is. But the idea is to have incredibly high critical standards, and of course incredibly high critical standards make you turn the searchlight on yourself. And so philosophy becomes a very inward-looking subject because it's trying to achieve these incredibly high standards and so on. And I mean, this meeting is a testament to the fact that philosophy can be rather inward-looking. But I think that's a kind of, you know, it's a sort of part of the great process of trying to understand the world. You've got to go back and look at the tools and all that sort of thing. But I mean, I try and keep the eye. I saw Red Bertrand Russell the other day saying exactly the same thing all the way through his long career. You know, he up and down all over the place. But his one target was, we're trying to understand the real world. You know, and he never wavered on that. And that's, I'm with that. And that's it. So I'm with the scientists. I just think trying to do it. We're all, you know, I see actually that I insulted scientists earlier, but I think it's teamwork, you know. People are trying to get different philosophers are part of the team, you know.
You take your apology, Peter, no problem.
Would the other speakers agree with them that our question, what is the point of philosophy, should necessarily exclude consideration of or answers to, for instance, what is the point of studying philosophy? And one possibility, such as its propensity to enable people to think, reason, explain, understand more clearly and more deeply. Maybe Anne might say that suggestions that have been mooted, that we should have more philosophy in our schools, for instance, as they have for a long time had in France, would not necessarily be a good idea. But if we are to include some of the usefulness of studying philosophy as well as philosophy, then we might have a different view. So Anne wanted to exclude what is the point of studying philosophy, you specifically said so, but a lot of people here might have thought, well, why exclude that? Couldn't we include that?
Are you asking me?
No, the others. If they agree with you, my question. Yeah.
Well, so I start off. I think what Anne was doing, if I understand it rightly, was simply to point out that the two questions are different.
Yes.
What's the point of philosophy? And one could be asking, what is the point of studying philosophy? Mm-hmm. And that's a perfectly valid question, but just not the particular one she was asking. But I think there is a point of studying philosophy, more or less, as you just said, gets people thinking.
I'd just like to make a comment which doesn't exactly answer the question. I think it is important to study philosophy, but not just for philosophers as a separate academic system, because I think there is the danger it becomes very introverted. I think it will be very important for scientists to study philosophy to better, I think it will be a great improvement in the training of scientists, but also science is so complex nowadays that maybe only scientists are in a position to do philosophy. I think that that's a possibility, and that if we don't have some sort of scientific background, then we're in a very poor position, really. The other thing I'd like to say in comparisons between science and philosophy is that science seems to have made this tremendous progress, if you like. Once Galileo came along and linked not just theory, but linked science to experiment, then kind of science took off and became accelerated progress. If you look at the history of philosophy, one thing that's a little bit worrying about it is we seem to be ploughing over the same fields over and over again, and you don't get such clear idea of philosophical progress that you do in science. Anyway, that's not to answer the question.
Say two things. One, I was rather struck by that point, you know, that I'm sitting here sort of saying, oh, we all ought to study philosophy, but it's a rather nice challenge. Are you in the position to study philosophy? Yeah, I think that's a very nice question. What are the pre-qualifications needed before you can do that? On the question of whether the point of philosophy is and why you study philosophy are two different things, no, I don't think they are at all. I think they're exactly the same thing. And it just strikes me, if you ask why are all the people in this room studying philosophy, there might be all sorts of questions along the lines of, well, you've got to do something in retirement or something like that, and that's true for me, you've got to do something, but why am I not doing pottery, or whatever, and I think the answer for almost everybody in this room is it dates back to childhood, you know, that somewhere around the age of 8 or 9 or something, you find yourself just puzzled by certain features of existence that don't seem to bother anyone else. Well, none of the other kids seem to care. And so you end up studying it, but you study it because you've seen the point of it, you know, which is you want to get this, you want to get at these background questions to the experience. You know.
Gentleman behind Patrick, sorry, I've got him.
Terry?
Terry, that's it.
Yes, this is a question for Anne. A brief answer. And this concerns me fundamentally. And it's to do with the train, the gravy train you had arriving in one part of your lecture, break three. So we were supposed to stick our heads on the line. For the life of God, this is what I have been doing for quite some time. And then this train comes rattling along, which includes neuroscience, psycholinguistics, and cognitive science. Scientists, there they are, coming towards me. The question is, they're going to destroy everything about me. So what I'm concerned, well, it says here, let's see, conceptions of what is to be a me. Right, so that disappears. I'm beginning to wonder what's left. So I'm a little concerned about what you have in mind after that. If, when hit by this train, containing all these strange sciences, what happens to the person after that? All things are destroyed, by the way I see myself.
I'm not trying to say that all things are destroyed. What I'm trying to say is that our previous conceptions as to what a person is going to go. And the most important thing which is going to go is the idea that a person is somehow that which can move around the world as it chooses, undetermined, and can behave in ways, well, basically can behave in terms of purposes, goals, and the totally traditional way in which we have thought of ourselves. And I think the there's Maggie Bowden, who came and spoke to us here together with Aaron Sloman about a year back. Her, one of her first, I think it's actually her first book, and I think it's the popularisation of her PhD thesis, so it's now quite old, is called On Purposive Explanation in Psychology. And what she's starting to do there, and of course she has developed it considerably across her lifetime, what she's starting to do there is to ask these sorts of questions about whether it makes sense to see a person, so for me to see me, for you to see you, to see a person as something which can, which does behave in ways which are not related to its experience. You know, I might water the roses, or I might murder my mother, who knows. You know, I'm a free agent, I might do one thing or the other. And she's asking us to, right back there, she's starting to ask us, to challenge that idea as to what a person was. And I think that a person, well, I've said this already, but I think that a person is, not has, but is, its experience. So your experience, being a different person from me, makes you a different person from me. And when you tackle the problem of, you know, what's the relationship between philosophy and science, like what we're trying to do here, you come at it from what you are, which is your experience, not what you have. There isn't a little... What's going to go is the idea that there's a little homunculus-type thing in here which has experience. And as I think it was Gaines Dawson put it, it's as though we think in terms of there being a little something 2 inches behind the eye and up a bit, that's where he put it, which either has or doesn't have experience, and if it doesn't have experience, it's still there sitting around right as it has some. Whereas in fact, he says, what we have to get used to is that the I itself is the experience. And given the differences in all our experiences, that explains the differences in all our psychologies, if you like. But it requires us to register that I am not as I have thought, I is a thought throughout history. I am not a thing which moves freely around the world doing what I choose to do. That's what's going to go, I think.
I thought that existed before the train arrived.
Sorry, what?
I thought that existed before the train arrived.
What existed before the train arrived?
That concept of me. That's me.
Oh, yeah. The concept of me has... Well,
so I'm interested to know what the change is, what the new birth is like.
What the new birth...
say that the 6.5 billion that is wandering around experiencing.
Yes. Well, what the new person is like, for example, remember that I say there, just as when we had come to discover that the earth moved around the sun, not the sun around the earth, everything still seemed the same. We still had suns rising in the east and setting in the west. I think even at the meteorological office, they still use this language. Even when we came to know through through gene sequencing that carrots and parrots do have quite a lot in common with Homo sapiens, it still seems as though we are fundamentally different from them. And when this train has come, it will still seem as though I am in some sense in here looking out upon you who are out there, but it just won't be the case, just as it isn't the case in the other two examples. And it won't be the case because what I will be, I think I have to add here, linguistically structured experience. That's what I is. Not what it has, what it is.
Now, when you're right about that, this is philosophy, this is what philosophy is about.
No,
this is why it's exciting.
Yeah.
But you can argue, somebody might argue, that you were talking about the relation between philosophy and science. And that is surely is almost a meta philosophical.
I would say that was a hypothesis. About Mike.
But no, honestly, just about on the deadline now, and I really want to change direction 180 degrees. Right? I feel we've got to bog down those of the technical points about science and philosophy, and the word philosophy is used in a wider sense, like moral philosophy, political philosophy, and things like that, which are very important areas for a lot of people. I think we all have philosophies, though, and probably everyone in this room is very aware that they have a philosophy in this more general sense. A lot of people aren't. I think it would be very healthy if people were, and there's a lot more Socratic questioning and why Jeremy Paxman and so on, to get at what people fundamentally, where they're coming from, where our politics are coming from politically, where our leaders are coming from politically, where we all come from politically, philosophically. It would be very healthy if we were much more aware of it and much more open about it. And I think, you know, your first session on Socrates, I thought, was a lovely approach. But I think we got it bogged down in relatively technical science, and do you see a much wider picture, a much wider use of the word philosophy? And I think it's very late in the day to ask the question, but
yes.
I'm getting it. Yes, I thought you probably would.
Incidentally, Socrates despised all research into the world and science. That's all a waste of time, he thought. But I don't think I'm able to get rid of
it. No, I wouldn't get rid of it.
I mean, if you just take politics or something, for example, we need to keep it.
Political philosophy.
You need to disentangle sort of politics from political philosophy. I mean, if you say, what should we do to prevent having further riots in Tottenham, that doesn't sound like a philosophical question. But everyone knows if you step back from that question and start broadening that question out, there's a sudden moment where everyone says, oh, we're getting a bit philosophical here.
Well,
and they're right. And
our politicians need to ask them those questions and make them answer them and say, what is your political philosophy? Where are you really coming from? This is what I'm getting at. It's a very important question to be able to get down to the philosophy underneath the practical philosophy.
Well, it's very much what I'm in favour of, but we need to identify where the philosophy is because we're interested in what the philosophy can contribute. And I would just say it's when it gets more abstract and more general, then you're in philosophy.
Yes, I agree.
I wonder if I could ask a question of my fellow speakers or anybody else out there, because I find it puzzling. What is a philosophical question as opposed to just a question? What makes a question philosophical?
Is that a question?
Why is that different from a question? Why is it not just a question?
A philosophical question is one that cannot, in principle, be addressed by science.
I think at that point I need to say that the bar is open.